KBOO Community Radio is proud to join the Native American Appreciation Club and Mecha Club in co-sponsoring the First University of Portland Powwow, Saturday, November 16th at 1 p.m. Everyone is welcome to come celebrate and honor Native American Heritage Month. There will be traditional Native and Aztec dancers, singers, drummers, vendors, and more. That's the First University of Portland Powwow to take place at the Child Center, 5000 Willamette Boulevard in Portland. More information can be found on the right-hand side of KBOO.FM under Community Events.
Good morning. You're tuned to KBOO Portland. It's 9:01. And coming right up, Political Perspectives. First up, we'll have Michelle Schroeder-Fletcher. She interviews professor and author Patrick Bratlinger about his book, States of Emergency, Essays on Culture and Politics. At 9:30, we'll hear about the history of the Philippines with Luis Francia, author of History of the Philippines. And at 10 o'clock, it's Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15 on Flashpoints, a new experimental theater piece based on the 1955 murder of 14-year-old Emmett Till. And an interview with author Warren Lehrer about his novel, A Life in Books, his new novel, A Life in Books, The Rise and Fall of Blue Mobley. And at 11 o'clock, The Dirtbag looks at when and how to harvest persimmon and parsnips and what to do with all those leaves. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support in our recent membership drive. You allow KBOO to thrive, and we appreciate you very much. Stay tuned now for Michelle Schroeder-Fletcher and her guest, Patrick Bratlinger.
This is Michelle Schroeder-Fletcher at 90.7 FM Portland. Today we're speaking with author and liberal scholar, historical archivist, and cultural critic Patrick Bratlinger about his new book, States of Emergency, Essays on Culture and Politics. Mr. Bratlinger is the author of many books, Bread and Circuses, Theories of Mass Culture as Social Decay, Who Killed Shakespeare, What's Happened to the English Language Since the Radical 60s, and several other books. Patrick Bratlinger is James Rudy Professor of English Emeritus at Indiana University, Bloomington. First, Mr. Bratlinger, welcome to KBOO, and thank you for your contributions of time and energy to help us understand this particular time in our culture.
Well, thank you for asking me to do this interview.
Yes. The first thing that you notice in reading your book is the diverse themes and the essays. Can you explain for our listeners kind of how you organized the book?
Sure.
And why?
Yeah. Over the past decade, I've been asked to contribute to a number of very different projects. For example, an anthology of essays on the Iraq War. In another case, an anthology of essays reconsidering the work of Marshall McLuhan. Still another anthology on interdisciplinary studies. And down the line, five of the essays in the volume are contributions to such projects. The other seven are new or recent essays that I've written specifically for this volume. I didn't plan the volume quite as it's turned out, but I have it divided between two sections. The first section is called Class Conflicts, and the second is called Postmodern Conditions. And I think the essays within each section cohere, and they play off each other, I think, in some ways that I hope will be illuminating. For example, one of the themes that has to do with economic issues very centrally is the notion of surplus populations or surplus people. And that's a theme that appears in several of the essays. For example, in the second essay, which is called quotation marks, "It's the Economy, Stupid."
Yes, which starts with a wonderful quote from George Bush. "We ought to make the pie higher."
Right. Yeah, by the way, that quotation, that epigraph to that chapter, "We ought to make the pie higher," is a good example of the very standard economics notion that we need growth at all costs. Now, of course, that notion runs right up against any kind of idea of ecological sustainability. We don't need growth at all costs, that's for sure. We need sensible economic policies that will provide prosperity for as many people as possible, jobs for as many people as possible, but not growth at all costs, not tar sands oil, for example. At any rate, to go back to the notion of surplus populations, it crops up in that second essay around, obviously, the idea of unemployment and the question of how unemployment comes about and how we might go about solving that problem. It crops up as well in the sixth essay on that section, which was co-authored by a former student of mine, Dr. Richard Higgins, on waste and value. Yeah, the interplay between those concepts, those categories, waste and value, in philosophical and economic thinking, really from John Locke down to the present, although we're focused in that essay particularly on H.G. Wells, the British Fabian socialist and novelist, and Thorsten Veblen, the American, some would say, maverick economist, the author of Theory of the Leisure Class around the turn of the 20th century.
And that's what's so interesting about the book. It's very deep in both a historical bent, but it's broad in its cultural references, too. I mean, in this same part of the book, you refer to Locke, and then you talk about the portrayal of the Indians as kind of a non-industrious and ignorant, both of civilization and money, and you suggest...
That's Locke, right.
Yeah, yeah, and you and again, you start there, and then you move forward, and you're talking about this interesting overview that you do so well in the book.
Well, yeah, and just to stick with Locke for a moment, John Locke, in his essays in the late 17th century, talks about what he sees as wastelands, the whole new world just being opened up, and the notion that's implicit in that idea of waste people, or people who are allowing the lands that they roam over lightly, as the expression had it, that is Native Americans.
rather than lived undependent on.
They didn't understand money, and they didn't understand property, according to Locke, and therefore they are themselves an early example of a waste or surplus population from that point of view, that is from Locke's point of view. That plays through the whole history of empire and colonization, I'm afraid, such that over and over again in various parts of the world, Australia, for example, the Aborigines in Australia were perceived as not understanding property, not having any concept of territory, of roaming lightly over the land, of not understanding money, and therefore, again, as being, even though some said they barely existed, as being a waste population. And therefore, again, some early colonists thought fit only for extermination. Now, that notion of waste populations or surplus populations, to go back to unemployment, figures in current thinking. And in the next to the last essay in the volume called Army Surplus, where I try to figure out a couple of things in that particular essay. One is I just start with the question of how can there be homeless and unemployed veterans in the wealthiest country in the world, the United States? These are our country's heroes, supposedly, right?
That's what we keep telling them. We appreciate their service.
Yes, and yet homelessness is very high among veterans. Unemployment's very high among veterans. The suicide rate is spiraling way out of control among veterans. And very little is being done. So homelessness and unemployment are central to that next to the last essay, Army Surplus. And I'm trying to figure out in that essay how it is that societies throughout history, really, as I understand it, I mean, I don't know everything about every society in the world, but certainly back to Locke's time, European societies, settler colonies, how these societies have proceeded to create populations within their own population that are seen as valueless or as surplus in some sense. So the unemployed, the homeless, etc. How do these processes of exclusion work? And in thinking about that, I'm also thinking about how particular kinds of genocides occur. That is, in particular, state-sponsored genocides where the target of the genocide is actually a population within the general population of a particular state. The Germans targeted Jews and Gypsies, yes, and they also targeted Germans themselves if the Germans were insane or criminal or...
Marginal in any way.
Marginal in some sense, exactly. And the essay leads me to cite the Italian philosopher Giorgio Agamben, who, in a couple of his essays, talks about the process of exclusion within a given society where a certain portion of a population, even if it's the same as the general population, is treated as having no worth. And this then goes to the issue of sovereignty, as far as Agamben is concerned. The sovereign is the power or the person who has the authority to determine the state of exclusion or the state of exception or emergency. This is another place in the volume where the notion of state of emergency plays through as a kind of theme. All of the essays have some bearing on the title of the volume, States of Emergency.
And it's clear that, like you say, through the book, even as the divisions between the chapters, there's always that constant theme of the power versus the powerless, how the exploitation continues,
right,
and how it's supported historically, which is what you do in the book so well, give a deep accounting of the history. In keeping with the theme of, you know, the amplified powerful or and the divide between the classes, you have a whole chapter which I think is particularly relevant now in terms of what we're dealing with and the ramifications about the Tea Party, and a little bit of a cultural historical background of what you think or how you think they came to power and what kind of power they exert. Can you explain that chapter a little bit to us, or that particular essay?
I'm laughing because the very thought of the Tea Party makes me laugh. That's one of the chapters in the volume that is, I suppose, most satiric. When I put it together, I was interested in doing that chapter, particularly finding out more about the Tea Party and what made it tick, you know, what led to its electoral success in 2010, which has now put the entire economy in jeopardy one more time.
Right.
So putting that chapter together and thinking of it as kind of, I wanted it to be kind of satiric. I didn't have any trouble making it satiric. All I had to do was quote people like Rush Limbaugh and Glenn Beck and Sarah Palin. They provide the satire themselves by the absolutely idiotic things they've said over the years. That chapter ends with a little playlet, which... again, is not exactly original with me, but I thought it'd be kind of fun to end an essay with a little play, a little drama. And it's called The Mad Tea Party. And that idea is not, again, it's not original with me, because a number of people like Richard Kim, who've written about the Tea Party, have used that metaphor from Alice in Wonderland. So that's the Tea Party chapter. I do try to make it a little bit serious in considering, as I understand it, the arguments of, when they're coherent arguments, of the Tea Party folks in light of an old and very famous essay by historian Richard Hostetter on paranoia in American politics. It's a great essay and often cited still, even though it's, I forget the exact date, I think it's back in the 60s that Hostetter wrote it, but his focus is on the attraction, particularly of conspiracy theories, to a certain mindset. And I can get wrought up about what I see as maybe potential conspiracies out there. I mean, That's very easy to do. But to see the entire world, and as I say, I mean, I'm quoting Hofstadter here, the paranoid types in American political history have often seen history itself as a gigantic conspiracy. And that's exactly the way Glenn Beck operates, for Pete's sake. I mean, sees everything as somehow a vast conspiracy in which, using his terms, the progressives are taking over. And this goes back to Woodrow Wilson and then forward to a figure like Francis Scott Piven and Acorn and, you know, down a long list of totally unconnected folks, except they happen to have progressive or liberal views about things.
First of all, I want to remind our listeners that we're speaking with author Patrick Brantlinger about his new book, States of Emergency, Essays on Culture and Politics. You know, it was said of you, Brantlinger writes for those insulted and injured by neoliberal economic policies and capitalist modernity in language accessible for action. So on that note, I wondered where you kind of see the culture moving in the near term to address some of these problems. And are you hopeful that the divide has become so great that maybe you can see a way that the pushback might address some of these answers?
Hard questions to answer. I don't have any easy answers. I think that here are some possibilities, put it that way. One is we saw the Occupy movement rise out of nowhere, and it's still there. It's kind of gone into the shadows for the moment, but it'll return. And I sense in what I see in the university students I've worked with and live around me and live here in Bloomington, a new kind of activism and urgency on the part of many of them. And that's all good. Same thing with faculty here at Indiana University. There are quite a few faculty who are activists in one way or another now on the local level, but more generally in relation to regional and national politics, people who belong to Solidarity, who, like I, belong to Jobs with Justice, and one way or another are trying to bring about greater equality, greater understanding of what's happening now within the United States about the growing rate of poverty, the attack on what's often these days called the social safety network, the attempts still by neoliberal economists to claim the market is the end-all and the be-all of all things. That's where the epigraph from Bush, we ought to make the pie higher, comes in.
And a lot of the economics that we're living with today, the theories and the structure that was put in place.
Right. For years now, the neoliberal economic orthodoxy has dominated economics departments, as I say in the second chapter. It's the Economy Stupid chapter. And people with more rational voices, at least voices I consider a lot more rational on the economic front, people like Michael Perlman or Michael Hudson, or for that matter, Paul Krugman and Joseph Stiglitz, who understand the quite obvious fact that markets are not perfect mechanisms, that there are all sorts of different kinds of markets, for one thing. So the notion that somehow the market or the marketplace will solve all problems and government should not interfere with them, I mean, this is such a... I hope your listeners will pardon me, a load of b***h. And yet it's been a dominant force in economic thinking and in economics departments. That's one of the reasons I set out in the book to argue, among other things, that cultural studies as an academic movement has, from the get-go back in the 60s, been a kind of counter-discourse to orthodox economics, that is, capitalist economics. The notion that markets and that capitalism unregulated will lead to prosperity for all is being contradicted every day by the increasing levels of poverty and inequality within our own country as well as abroad, so that, well, we know what the poverty level is now in the United States. I think it's over 50 million are below our own poverty rate. And people have written about, have begun writing about the United States as a third world country. Well, then add to that the effects of NAFTA, and I write about NAFTA some, and other trade agreements, but particularly NAFTA, in the chapter on Mexico. What's the matter with Mexico? Well, what is the matter with Mexico? NAFTA went into effect in 1994, and it was supposed to bring increased prosperity to all three countries who were signatories to, that is, the United States, Mexico, and Canada. One upshot is the increased outsourcing, loss of jobs within the United States. Another is the absolutely disastrous effects on the peasant farming economy in Mexico. Mexican peasants since 94 have been forced off the land because of NAFTA, because NAFTA, along with our own government subsidies to big agribusinesses, have led those businesses to dump corn onto the Mexican market. And that has completely destabilized the small farm economy in Mexico and driven those people to avoid starvation. They can't find jobs, they can't work the land anymore, north of the border. And then, of course, we have the immigration crisis on top of it, and more, by the way, more surplus population in one sense. Mexican workers here trying to find employment in the midst of our own unemployment crisis.
We now are in a place where people are starting to put the pieces together, to understand that it's not them individually at fault or that they're part of a bigger structural system.
Well, I hope so. I hope more and more people are beginning to see the larger picture, because it is one that where in the past the neoliberal economic and political orthodoxy has contended or chosen to believe that capitalism, especially after the fall of the communist regimes in the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe, would somehow blossom and broaden out and bring prosperity around the globe. That is not happening. The reverse is happening. And people have to wake up to that fact to figure out how to create a system on a really a global scale that will resolve a number of issues, whether within some kind of revised capitalist mode or in some new form of democratic socialist mode, such that we bring under control the growingly obvious bad effects of unregulated capitalism, that is, increased unemployment. Just to go back to that notion of surplus population and unemployment.
Yes.
For a second.
Yes, no.
And that is a main theme throughout the book.
Book, yes.
Capitalism always works. Unregulated capitalism is always going to work to employ as few workers as possible.
That's its goal.
Yes.
I mean,
At the same time, capitalism needs, as Marx argued, it needs a reserve army of labor, that's Marx's phrase, a reserve army of labor to help keep labor costs down, to keep them in reserve. The immigrant population in this country now is like a secondary reserve army of labor to go along with all the other unemployed people we've got in the country. And yes, through automation, through outsourcing, through union busting, through other means, capitalist enterprises are always at work to limit the number of workers and to pay them as little as possible. So something has to be done to counteract that. The other really, really major effect that people are beginning to wake up to is global warming. And that, too, if we just let it go, that's going to be another result of rampant capitalism out of control, burning fossil fuels. You know, we've been doing that since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution. And scientists now say they know that the warming of the planet, and particularly the warming of the oceans, has increased more rapidly since the onset of the Industrial Revolution. In one article I read recently, over the last 65 million years. So we're in trouble.
It's because from an economic perspective, there's no reason to stop because it continues on as a preferred outcome because it makes money in the short term.
Exactly. And from the point of view of any corporation or business, just that narrow point of view, none of this other stuff matters.
Exactly.
It's all externalities, as the economists say.
And that's a perfect spot to stop and recognize that that is the importance of your book and people like you writing on a broader, deeper, more historical and cultural overview of where we were, where we are. It gives great inspiration or at least hope that we can move forward with at least that knowledge. I want to thank you. You've been listening to author Patrick Brantlinger talking to us about his new book, States of Emergency, Essays on Culture and Politics. Thanks again for your insight and contribution, interest in these important topics.
Well, thank you very much for talking to me.
It's really important, and again, helping us understand better some of the historical explanations and cultural overview is what our hope is to try and change the trajectory of the future.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you very much. Again, this is Michelle Schroeder Fletcher speaking from KBOO 90.7 FM Portland.
And you are listening to KBOO at 90.7, also on the web at www.kboo.fm. At 9:30, just coming up in a couple minutes, we'll hear the story of the Philippines with Luis Francia, author of History of the Philippines. At 10 o'clock, Air Cascadia. At 10:15, Flashpoints. And at 11 o'clock, The Dirtbag. And all that coming up on political perspectives for today. Coming up, let's see, we're going to go to one little announcement, and then I'll come right back and tell you what we're going to hear.
45 DJs
play 45 RPM records
all day.
Tune into KBOO on November 16th from noon to midnight
for a special 45th anniversary celebration.
DJs will play 15-minute sets of 45 RPM records.
While from noon to 8 p.m., we'll have an open house birthday party at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue with refreshments,
birthday cake, station tours, and more.
So join us November 16th.
In person at KBOO from noon to 8 p.m. and on air from noon to midnight.
To celebrate our 45th year of serving the musical, political, and cultural needs of the Portland metro area, Cascadia, and the world.
For more information, go to kboo.fm/45RPM2013.
KBOO Community Radio. And coming up next, we hear an interview from the series Letters to Washington, Letters and Politics with host Mitch Jezerich. The situation in the Philippines remains dire as rescue attempts are hampered by damage, debris, bad weather, and bureaucracy. One of the first responders to the typhoon last Friday was the U.S. military. The Marines were on the ground as early as Saturday. A key reason that the U.S. military could act so quickly is that the military has a 100-year-plus presence in the Philippines. The U.S. occupation of the Philippines that began in 1898 is considered one of the first overseas imperial adventures in the U.S. rise to global dominance. Mitch Jezerich spoke with Luis Francia about the history of the Philippines in his book by that name, The History of the Philippines, before the recent disaster in that country. The interview provides insight on the history and current politics there. Stay tuned for that.
This is Michelle Schroeder.
It's good to have you here.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Let's begin in 1898. Interesting history that connects in the last 120 years or so the United States to the Philippines. But actually, we're going to begin in Havana, Cuba. 1898, USS Maine was anchored off of Havana. The ship was blown up. And immediately, the Spanish were blamed for this. We saw this blame in, from U.S. newspapers. Many people know about William Randolph Hearst, who said, quote, "You furnish the pictures, I'll furnish the war," and using the press to get the United States at war with Spain. At the same time, Spain is dealing with a revolutionary war in the Philippines.
Right. Actually, the revolution in the Philippines began in 1896.
Yeah.
So it had been ongoing for basically 2 years when the USS Maine blew up and provided an excuse for the United States to join the big boys in the game of empire, you know, because that was basically what the United States was looking for, an excuse to be able to, as they called it then, participate in the great game.
Yeah.
And they saw that Spain was a doddering old lady on her last legs, and the Cuban Revolution begins in 1895. They send the warship Maine, USS Maine, ostensibly, it's a term very familiar to all of us now, to protect U.S. interests. And as they say, the rest is history. So yes, the war against Spain was meant on a public level to help both the Cubans, the Philippines,